The first question is, what is your view on sitting meditation outdoors?
Yeah,
I think if it works for you, then try it, whatever feels comfortable. The standard to judge your meditation by is, you know, whatever makes the mind settle down. You find it's too stuffy in here or too cramped, and sitting outdoors brings awareness, it brings stability of mind, brings comfort. Yeah, then by all means, please experiment with it. And if it works, yeah, please continue doing that. It's no problem. Any questions or comments? Is, could you please talk a bit about what brought you to this path in life and whether you have experienced much suffering? Thanks. Yes, there's plenty of suffering. And unfortunately, this path is also enclosed plenty of suffering still. Because sometimes you have this kind of, you know, fantasy that you come into the monastery and everything is hunky dory. No, I mean, the same person before I started. But I think, just a little bit, and I'll backtrack regarding what brought me here. But I think, you know, it's when you're in a monastery, at least you're beginning to train the mind, and you're in an environment that's conducive to training, because there's nothing else to do. Most forest monastery, meditation monastery, is set up very simple routine, and you do the same thing over and over again. So it allows you to see the mind more clearly. But having said that, like I said, because we're still in training, when you're ordained, it just means you're in training, you're not enlightened yet. So there's plenty of things to kind of work on. I know sometimes people come and look and say, ah, great dinner, monk. You don't have to cook, people bring you food, and then they clean up after you, they come and run off for everything, you think, ah, I want to be a monk or a nun in a few years' time. I cordially invite you, please, spend a week in the monastery, spend a month in the monastery, whatever you have time of, and you'll see that actually it can be quite challenging, because there's no distraction. Whatever state of mind that comes up, you've got to sit with it. You can't run off to see a friend, have dinner, go to a movie, go on a date. All that is cut off, and you become a nun or a monk. You've got to work through whatever it is that comes up in your mind. And in a way, it's quite exciting. Quite challenging, but also quite exciting, quite rewarding. Before I was a monk, I was a stockbroker. Worked in finance for a few years. I was working in Bangkok. And, you know, living a very fast and exciting life. Traveling to different places, to Hong Kong, New York, London. But moving very quickly, because that's the lifestyle demanded that. You know, always constantly reading the newspaper, reading many newspapers, keep up with the dates, with the fast information. That way you can give, you know, advice on different stocks for people to buy. So always constant reading and researching. Things changing all the time. And also the lifestyle itself, the traveling, moving around. The thing I found was one of the things I reflect on when I joined a monastery was that because I was moving around and my mindfulness was not very sharp. After a while, or, you know, a few years, life became very dull. Yeah, to the different cities, the same restaurants, few chicken, few beef you're eating, nice beach, all beaches are the same. You go to the bars, all the bars, because of globalization, everybody plays the same music. Every single bar has the same music, same boring American music that they play. So after a while, I found that life became very boring, and also because of this, you know, waiting for the next hit, the next experience, the next, you know, next movie, next destination, next deal that you're going to close, next promotion, next new suit, new car, whatever. It's constantly searching, looking. That I felt, actually, more discontent. As I became more, get more what I wanted. Feel more of a hopeless. You always need to kind of feel with Buddhist when I was and became a monk, and had to endure in the beginning a very boring routine. You wake up very early, chanting, then in Thailand you go in arms around, walk around the villages, with your bowl and they put food in there, you go back, you eat your meal, and then you clean, and then you go back, and there's nothing to do in the hut. You go back to your hut, and there's nothing to see in the hut, didn't have a video, didn't have my phone to call my friends, didn't have money, I couldn't do very much. But I found that the short time that I spend there is that because my mind was increasing, that life was very interesting. Every day it was a new adventure, walking arms around. Wow. How is my feeling? What does that feel like? You know, walking the same path. I can see different sets of emotions come up. Some days, you know, it was really good. Some days, mood was darker. And just investigate, why was this? I don't know, I found it. The fact that it was a control environment allowed me to clear it into my mental makeup more. And it was just fascinating to see all the changes brought about. And so I find, I don't know whether you know it or not, but being a Theravada monk, you don't have, it's not a lifetime commitment. It's not like where you're a Christian monk, the Sarian or the Carthusian, where you make a lifelong commitment. No, here, the only commitment I made is that I will, when I'm a monk, I will follow as best as I can all the rules that I take on. But if something else better come up, I shouldn't be wearing jeans tomorrow. And that's the thing, that because you're happy to do what you're doing, you don't need to change. And I find myself that as long as I'm happy, content, looking into my mind, training it, inclined towards gentleness, towards kindness, and it's still a very exciting and fulfilling path. And so there's no kind of pressure to stay in the monk unless I'm getting happiness from it. And if I'm getting some fulfillment, some happiness, some contentment, then I continue. It's the same with everybody. If you're getting, if you're happy doing what you're doing, then you continue doing that for as long as you can. And backtrack. The thing that brought me into my monastic role is actually with not so uncommon, like most people, just by chance. I grew up Catholic, but not particularly religious. Growing up in Southern California, and just go on to my business. Being immigrant, came just before the fall of Saigon. My mother worked for the Americans, so we got evacuated 2 weeks early before the fall of Saigon. But we came to the U.S., being a refugee. My parents, because they gave everything up, instilled us a sense of work ethic, to work hard and to be successful, to do well in school, to have a decent job, because that's what they told me, that's what happiness is. Get a good grade, get a good job, start a family, and that's where happiness is. And so I was, wasn't so interested in religion. And also being educated in the West, you view religion in not so favorable light. Religion is something, I remember Marx saying, it's opium for the mass. That's what religion is like. Because it's not scientific, it's focused. I was working as a stockbroker at the time, and I guess I was ready, because a friend of mine was visiting, and he was being in California. There's always different spiritual stuff to be into. So at that time, Theravada Buddhism happened to be the it thing for the time being. So he traveled, he'd been in Thailand for a few times, so he did the bar thing, did the beach thing, did a whole bunch of different things. And was looking for a new experience, something he can go back and tell his friend about, obviously. And I've never been to the monastery, that's not something to do. And in Thailand you can be a monk, or a novice, or a nun for a short time. So I'll be a monk for 2 weeks, see what that feels like. So that's what he did. He took robes to be a monk for 2 weeks, but did not know too much about Buddhism, and also not so interested in meditation, he knew a little bit about it. But obviously he found very quickly life in the monastery very, very boring. Nothing to do after the meal, and that's about it. So he became bored very quickly, so he called me up. I'm really bored about guts, you know, another week to go. Why don't you come and keep me company? How much I can talk to you? Because there's a whole bunch of time. I was like, oh no, I don't want to do this. With her wrath, he harangued me. He said, come on, you gotta go. I can't speak Thai. There's only Thai people around. And this one English monk, though, his teacher was an English monk. But he's busy doing other stuff, so he can't entertain him all day long. He's only talking for a few hours. So he said, okay, come in. And that's the reason why that's my introduction to Buddhism. I was just going in to keep my friend company. And I had the good karma of meeting this very good teacher. He was an English monk in a monastery outside of Bangkok. And that's when he started explaining to me the kind of basic Buddhist concept of karma. Saying karma is, you know, whatever goes around, comes around. Like, that makes sense. I always believe in like justice. If you do good things happen to you. It'll come back. But I didn't necessarily believe in the ultimate God, that someone's up there handing out. Well, that's my conception of Christianity, anyway, Catholicism. No, it's not correct, but that's what I believed, anyway. It doesn't make sense. But to me, I felt like there is a sense of justice. There is a universal law. And so that, I felt, okay, I can resonate with this concept that whatever, you do good things happen, you do things, anger, irritation, these will come back to haunt you later on. I couldn't really verbalize it. And the other thing was, he taught me meditation. He started to teach me what mindfulness is about, is like, and what meditation is like. And he said that if you're a good meditator, you can see the future. So the stockbroker, I'm like, okay. I think I'm going to do this one. I think I'm going to put a lot of effort in doing this. So I was very diligent. I was focusing on my breath all day, all night. You want to talk to my friend after that? I said, no, I've got things to do. So, unfortunately, you know, it's not that easy. But it piqued my interest. And I think came together. This meditation, because during that time, it was in the late 90s. You may not remember, but during that time, 1998, there was a huge, last year, financial crisis. The baht tumbled, was devalued for the first time, and the stock market crashed as well. So, which also shook my confidence. Because when the market's going up, you're like, wow, I'm a genius. Everything I pick go up, it's great. when the market goes up 30% a year, it will always go up 30% a year. That's normal. Of course, markets don't do that. It goes the other way as well, very quickly as well. But when it goes up, you have this great, big, huge sense of self because you think you're making all the right decisions. And then when it goes the other way, you're like, I don't have all the answers to life. If I'm wrong about the stock market, I could be wrong about a host of other things. Like, what is happiness? What is the meaning of life? And so that jolted me a little bit. And also the thing that came together for myself as well is what, you know, growing up, you know, being a refugee, kind of poor, parents worked very hard, you know, to go to class. And you always thought happiness, got a new car, bigger house, 4-bedroom house with swimming pool, will be happy. When I make my money, that's all I want, I'm going to be happy. Because I'm finally going to get the car and the house I want. Or that's where happiness lies. And then when success came, very quickly, when you work in the stock market, you know, your salary can double, triple. In a few years now, no problem. And things were going well because the market in Thailand was going up. And then you became, you know, I bought the things I wanted to buy, did the traveling I wanted to travel, and I looked up the line to my managers and my directors, and I saw that these were fabulously wealthy people. And they had everything. But they didn't seem any happier than I am. They didn't seem to know what they're doing either. When you were young and poor, you kind of projected all this idolization. See, they're rich and famous, that they have the answer somehow, they've got it right, deserves, you know, there they are. The beautiful cars, beautiful houses, they must be happy. And you get closer, you're like, oh, they're just as miserable as I am. I'm like, why am I working so hard? Not getting a whole lot more. So that sort of, kind of, these things all came together during this week, when I guess when you had time to kind of reflect, when you weren't so busy working. So that's why I think I was in a space to start looking for happiness somewhere else. I said I tried other sense experience, you know, the travels and the shopping and the different things, and the bars and whatever other. And it some happiness, but those happiness whole in my stomach I couldn't feel. And yet, I said that week in the monastery, just kind of being in a quiet environment, I felt an inkling of something, something pure, something that worth pursuing. I couldn't really put my finger on it. And also, I guess I was in the space where set up with Thailand, the market wasn't doing anything, so I thought, okay, I'll move back to New York and start over. So because I was moving, I had the time, so I didn't have to move back right away, because New York stock market will always be there. Take a year off, learn how to meditate, clean up New York. Once I get there, once I develop my psychic powers, so I take a year off, and that's how I do, perfect my meditation, rich in family. But unfortunately, I did, and that's where I went to Wat Phanattachat, which is one of a branch monastery of Ajahn Chah, to learn how to meditate. And it took a year of just a little meditation, and didn't really want to become a monk. That was a lot, I didn't really, it was even an option. Just to learn to meditate, to relax, and then to go back to the real world. That's where things are at. But I think once my mind became more still, and the meditation began to kind of come together, then, first time in my life, being like, ah, this is what happened. This is what contentment is. So, and I also realized, I did talk to my teacher, I'm like, you know, my meditation is getting pretty good, Ajahn. Should I go back? I'm like, don't be stupid, you're deluded. It's good now because you're in a monastery in a peaceful place. So you go back to New York, it's going to fade, and you're going to lose it. And but also, by then, I was getting enough peace in my meditation, and some of the wisdom starts to arise. That peace and contentment comes from inside, it doesn't come from outside of having things, having experiences, forgetting things. So that's when I started to say, okay, I'll do this for 5 years or something. And like I said, I haven't looked back since. So my introduction to Buddhism was rather very fast. I was in the monastery within a month. And I think because I didn't have a plan on it. And it might sound kind of incredible or uncommon, but actually when I talked to other monks, there was a monk in Victoria. And the same thing, this 17-year-old boy who was just, you know, was, I think, driving around, he saw a monastery, so went in and looked. And I think Kalyana says, you know, he called his parents at night and said, oh, I think I'll visit here for a few days and see what happens. And he's been a monk there for a few years already. He hasn't left since that day. So these things come together. And not to say that you have to be monk and nun to practice Buddhism. You certainly don't have to do that. Meditation works on all different levels. And also, if you do have intention to become monk or nun, to also to realize that it's many things that come together. That you know, it's more of an organic and natural path. When the timing is right, things will start to open up, things will come together, and you don't have to push or pull. You do have to, you feel that you want to become a nun or a monk, and things might come together, you feel like people are, there's lots of obstacles in the way, and it's probably not a good time just yet. But just to wait patiently, continue with your practice, and these things will come together naturally, in a way that's very unexpected. Questions or comments? Does that make sense? please talk about open eye meditation? Briefly discussed this already, just for the benefit of other people who might be curious about the same thing. Yes, generally we recommend people to close their eyes because it brings the awareness inside. But sometimes it has the opposite effect. Sometimes people close their eyes and the mind goes off somewhere. Different back to the future, back to the past, towards the future, fantasizing. So to keep your eyes closed, open, you can roughly focus in the space in front of you or the candlelight. But try to keep it in one spot, not to look to the left or look to the right. And also the ultimate test is to watch the mind. Is your mind awake, aware, and alert in the present moment? Stable? If it's stable, happy, and content, then it's working. But you find that it gets disturbed when people just stand up and move around, you find that you get caught up in that, then maybe it's better to close your eyes. So anything, just experiment to see whether it works for yourself or not. Questions or comments? How can I continue to strive for a quiet mind in the midst of contemporary Western society? Is it possible to get stillness in such conditions? Are you living in a city? Yes. That's very difficult. But also, I think by practicing contentment, it goes a long way. If you're in the middle of Sydney, it's never going to be as quiet as in the bush. But that, you know, but you can make peace with that. A lot of, you know, stillness, external stillness helps, but it's not absolutely essential. As long as you find a quiet place in your apartment, your flat somewhere, and you can sit. And it doesn't have to be for very long. You can sit 5-10 minutes. You build up the stability of the mind. Build up with a regular routine. And also, that's what places like these are for. Time to time, you take time off, and you go to a quiet place. Strengthen your practice. I mean, in theory, it should be no problem. But in practice, in theory, you know, you're a good meditator. You can meditate in a marketplace. You can shut everything out and just focus on the breath. But that's in theory. In practice, physical seclusion helps a lot. And just to know that. But also, the opposite end of the spectrum is that you are in a big city already and you have a full life, kids, jobs, family, and also to make the best of it. You said, okay, this is my responsibility. I have responsibility for my, you know, partner, my husband, my wife. So I'm going to make peace with that. Whatever what time I have during the day, and there's always a couple of minutes you can find during the day. Stay quietly, relax your body, watch the breath for a few minutes. You'd be surprised how much benefit, how much result you get. As long as your mind is always inclined towards peace and stillness. When you have a few minutes, don't start to plan for it. Oh, what should I do when I get back? What should I call somebody up? What should I do? But actually, wherever you are, just be there. Be in the body. When you're sitting on a train, doing your body, what's my back? What's my breathing? My shoulder. Relax my chest. Am I anxious about something? My stomach. Just to keep your awareness there. Just not much. It can help a lot. If you reduce it, you find that you're actually keeping watch your mind throughout the day. Then this awareness, this mindfulness, very strong. It's very easy for you to watch the breath or do metta meditation. As long as you control your mind, as you go about doing your thing. That's why walking meditation is great. We were constantly walking around. Instead of, you know, we normally walk around. Once I get my office, call this person, write this down, coffee, who's going to have for lunch, blah, blah, blah. But next time when you walk, you're just walking. You walk. What's the sensation my feet feels like?
body feels like, the muscles in my leg, the skin rubbing against my shirt or the dress or whatever, what does that feel like? Just to pay attention to those little details that ground your awareness in the present moment. And then when you're living in a big city or busy, it's not such an issue. But like I said, it always kind of helps tremendously to go to a quiet place from time to time to empower your meditation. To continue to give depth to your mind, to the peace in your mind. Okay. Make sense? Questions or comments? Explain how to manage, teach the mind, because sometimes the mind has ill will, bad thoughts, unwholesome. Thank you, Bhante. First is just to accept it. Accept because we're unenlightened, because we have inside of us wholesome qualities as well as unwholesome qualities. That is normal. From time to time, these wholesome qualities will come to the forefront. Especially when we're tired, busy, didn't have enough sleep, things come up. First to accept it as normal. And then just kind of to work with them. Is the ill will come into? First, you know, usually ill will or anxiety has a physical counterpart. You always, there's a tension in the body somewhere. So I just recommended to a few people today, instead of just go to the trigger, whatever annoyed you, whatever pissed you off, you go to the body. Where is the nervousness, anxiety in the body? In your stomach? In your chest? I'm trying to relax that part. I guarantee you there's a tension there somewhere. In your shoulders. And try to relax that part. Go to the physical sensation first. And that does two things. One, it gets your mind off the trigger. Why is she saying that to me? How dare her? I'm her friend. All the things I've done for her. You get more angry in 2 minutes. If you go to the body, you start to relax the body. And it takes your mind away from the trigger. And also by relaxing the body, the mind also has a chance to unwind. Mind has a chance to kind of open up, because you're not thinking about what annoyed you so much about this person, about the situation. So that's one of the things to work with in an unwholesome state of mind. And also just to kind of watch them. Don't take it personally, because this is my state of mind. Yeah, okay, this is interesting. Yeah, unwholesome thought coming up. I'm feeling irritated. I'm really, really pissed off. Okay, where this is going to lead us. Look at John's famous example. The next time you get mad, really, really mad, take a walk. See how far, how long can you be mad for? How long can you be mad at this person or situation for? Keep a journal, write that down. Oh, I was really pissed off for 2 hours. And the next time you get mad, take out the clock again. And keep a record. Because then when you do that, you realize that, you know, your emotions, your moods, like anything, changes. And it's non-self, in the sense that you're not in control. You find that, you know, after a few hours, a few minutes, something distracted your mind, the mood goes away. And when you take out the clock, you're not taking yourself so seriously as well. It's just, you know, I am so angry, and you go on and on about it. Like, yeah. It's anger, and it comes up quite a bit. Because in the past, well, this is how I think. This is where I'm inclined towards. So these different, you know, practices brings attention to what we're doing, brings mindfulness, awareness. And once you have that, it's almost automatic. Once you take out the clock, you can kind of start laughing at yourself already. This is so silly. Why am I doing this? Why am I getting mad? Who am I getting mad? And also to remember, right, when we're mad at somebody, want to get back to them. We want to hurt them. Really make them suffer. But who is it? Who is it that's suffering? That person is gone. He or she is, you know, having a good time somewhere else. And we're the one left with this anxiety, with this pent-up emotion that makes us tight. So it's actually not a very logical response to situation or people. Because someone said, you know, anger is like, you know, picking up a hot piece of coal. Someone annoys you, someone hurts you, intentionally or unintentionally. You don't care. You want to pick up and you want to toss them, you want to hit them. You want to burn them badly. But, who gets burned first? In order for you to do that, you've got to pick up the piece of coal. That's already burning. And then, sometimes they're not around, so you have to hold that thing for a while. A couple hours, a couple days, more pain and suffering. You're really paying attention to it. And the next time you see them walk by, ha, get done. I'll get you. And you toss at them. And sometimes you're a good aim, you hit them. Sometimes you're a bad aim, you miss. So all that suffering for nothing. And then, most often, guess who you hit? You hit your own members of the family, people you're closest to. Because that's who you take it out on. So when you reflect, when we're not angry, we reflect on these things more rationally. Oh, okay. This is very silly. But like I said, emotions are not something that we can cure rationally. But I think bringing mindfulness to it, each time, you're cutting away this kind of tendency towards anger, towards aversion. You see that, you know, it doesn't do you any good. Certainly doesn't do any people around you any good, because when you're angry, you let them have it as well. So they're not very happy to be around you if you're in a bad mood. And they know that. And you know that. So you're like, maybe they shouldn't be. And also, you notice, like I said, being around an angry person is not very fun. So obviously you said, okay, I should be angry then. So, you know, there's many ways to kind of relate, to deal constructively with whole unwholesome thoughts, especially anger and ill will. The Buddha said something interesting. He said that anger and ill will is very painful, very destructive, but easy to let go, which is interesting. Because I think because it's so obvious, pain in it. Although I think in our society, like to get worked up, righteous anger is a good thing. Once you make the world a perfect place, and someone's, you know, polluting the environment, and we get very angry when, you know, we go on demonstration, we write petitions, we bring attention to this. The righteous anger is something that's encouraged. But we look carefully, even there's no such thing as righteous anger. People are the way they are. Things are the way they are. It's not perfect. But I think getting angry at things actually adds to the problem rather than relieving it. It's when we're calm, when we're actually cool, that we can actually find solutions, constructive solutions to the world's problem much better. When we're angry, we're irritated, we're actually clouding our own mindfulness, and we're increasing, you know, we're decreasing the immune system, we're increasing the chance of getting sick. He said that the thing that's more subtle is actually thoughts of sexuality. Having nice things, wanting things to go your way, that's actually thought of lust and greed. It's more subtle because there's many levels of greed. And that's harder to get rid of, actually. That's thoughts of greed. And you can see within us, obviously, the coursing is one of things. A new suit, new car, new toy. That's obvious. Okay, I don't need that. Plenty of toys and that doesn't bring happiness. But then the subtle thing of wanting to be something, wanting having, you know, wanting good meditation, and also subtle forms of greed. And it's, you know, and something that we have to pay attention to. You want to get deep meditation. Meditation is about letting go. Because when you want something, there's a shaking, a quivering in the mind already, wondering whether you get it or not. Even you get very good meditation, when you sit down and like, oh, you see the quivering in the mind already, if it starts to project in the future, just to worry. I want to hold on to this good experience. Oh, I had a really great meditation. You can see that in the place of the mind. When you want something, you're automatically dividing, you know, kind of separating yourself. gives you one something you don't have. If you don't have it, so you suffer until you get it. So that's the reason why. If you want stillness, it's a path of just letting go, the path of being accepting whatever's happening. And then the mind will open up and the meditation progresses all by itself. That's the thing to keep in mind. That we want happiness, but we must, you know, we must not kind of reach out for it. To be more patient or clever. To stand still. Just patient, just to be here. And then happiness, contentment will come naturally. That's Ajahn Chah's famous dhimma. Said the Buddha, did all the work. He discovered what meditation is like, discover how to train the mind. It's like he's grown this wonderful orchard of mangoes. It's ripe, lots of them, full of them, you know, the trees are full of them. All we need to do is sit underneath the tree and stick our hand, and they'll fall automatically. And it's a great simile for stillness, for patience. He didn't say to go climb the tree, to knock it down. So you have to grow your own tree. No, it's all grown. The teachings are all there. We need to just have enough patience. Just still. And things work out themselves. The same with unwholesome states of mind. Just be patient. Just to see. And just to watch them. And once you've been through one depression or one dark mood, have the courage to sit through them, and you'll see that yes, these things come and they go on their own accord. And that's why one of the great training as a monk or nun in the monastery is, yes, we come to the teaching, the Dhamma, Buddhism, we're very excited, full of aspiration, full of faith, full of inspiration. Ah, it's great, my teacher is really good, I'm sure he's enlightened already. And then the monastery for a year is like, oh God, yes, he tells these horrible jokes all the time. I had to hear him 100 times. Then it was the first time. Then he goes, ah, no, no, no. My fellow monks in the holy life, they're not very perfect. They're full of defilements. We fight each other all the time. You're full of greed. Because there's nothing else to do. You look at the other monks, you criticize. That's the common habit. Then you're like, oh, God. But that's the thing with monks. You work through all these kind of peaks of inspiration. And the depths of desperation, such as Ajahn Chah. First it's inspiration, then sure enough the desperation comes. But, as a senior monk, what you have is experience behind you. You've gone through this depth where nothing's happening, you're hitting your head against the wall month after month and nothing happens in meditation. But something inside you says, that's okay. A little faith, you know, from a long, long time ago or something. This is the tried, true, trodden path. Many thousands of people have done this before. Just sit here. Do anything. Just make it through today. No high goals. Make it through today. And if you're in such a pissed off mood, I don't care, but I'm not going to disrupt just that. Once you work through this one day, 2 days. And that's the thing, you sit through it and you see that this dark mood, this disappointment, the annoyance that build up from time to time. They do pass. Like anything else. And that's why it's a great training. Because you have no choice. You don't have the telephones, you don't have the internet to distract yourself. You have to sit through. But with that comes a natural wisdom. You see it clearly in your own experience, not in someone else's experience. In your own experience. Oh, these things pass. You see that, and also next time you get really inspired again, you don't get so caught up in it. You're like, oh, okay, yeah, no one's upswing. Yeah, things are great, things are happening. And, you know, Ajahn Brahm gives great Dhamma talk. No jokes, do Dhamma talk. Good, things are good. You get along with your fellow monks. Yeah, great. Yeah, okay, holy life is good. But you know that these things also pass away. Don't get so disappointed. You don't get so afraid when you're not so inspired anymore. Because sometimes you do that, you feel, you know, guilty. Why am I in such a pissed off mood? I feel so like this. When people feed me, they know how terrible a mood I'm in. Oh. But you
realize that you are still in training and that you're still continuing the training. But that's why just this kind of watching the mind, not taking yourself seriously, to see that these moods come and they go. And after you see, work through a few of them, then there's no problem. You can center yourself very quickly. Moods come, and then here you go again. These dark moods that come. It's like the weather. Sometimes the clouds come, rains a little bit, it gets flooded out. Whatever. And then it goes away all by itself. The sun comes up. Very beautiful day. That's the look at the mind the same way. Moods come, stay for a while, they change. And then same with the good and the bad moods. So the mind has this kind of internal centeredness. It has its own strength after a while. You know that no matter what happens outside, you have the confidence just to watch and not react. Confidence that you can always lean, incline your mind towards harmlessness, maybe keeping the precepts throughout the years, incline your mind towards kindness and gentleness. Because that's where you've been trying to train your mind. And after a while, in this group I was telling you yesterday, it becomes deeper and the mind just goes there automatically. But these take time. It takes patience. It takes perseverance. But this is something that can be done to each and every one of us. And that's why it's great to go to monastery to meet monks and nuns who've done it. The way you should say that, yes, in the 21st century, still people very happy, living simple lifestyle. Who are happy regardless of what happens and what's happening outside. Who are happy just to be in the present moment. So that's the other thing. So one of the other inspiration where I stay as a monk, actually, at the end of my noviceship, years up, I was actually happy to go back to and then we visited these meditation masters in the different monasteries in Thailand, and seeing them, like I said, the contrast I had was seeing these wealthy, fabulous, wealthy people, famous and powerful people in Thailand, and they've been very happy. And then seeing the contrast, the simple monks living in the forest, nothing. You know, cheap room, simple room, simple hut. They're very, very happy, very at peace. And this amazing amount of compassion to radiate towards, you know, outside other people visiting them. Oh, okay. This is interesting. I want some of this. Obviously, some craving involved, but at least craving towards, you know, purity, towards goodness. And that intrigued me to give this lifestyle a try. It is the meaning. Because other times, you know, Buddhism can be just something dry, something academic. It can be just books, trying to fumble and work your way through. The meaning, you know, well practiced. Deep practitioners, there's a lot of faith that can be done. Questions or comments? Hear that? She said that it's one thing to track kind of your anger, aggression, feeling in the body, you know, tightness, and that's quite obvious. But what about feelings of sensuality, erotic feelings? Is going to the body a good place for that? I think with that depends on the strength of your mindfulness. You see that it is actually another stimulation. Something gets excited, you know, the blood starts to go into that beacon or whatever. Something's happening, but you just stand back and just watch it. But anything, it comes and it goes. but also you feel that if you do feel you get caught up into the feeling, the emotions of the erotic feelings, I think then you can reflect. And also it depends on the training, where you're at. If you're in a retreat, then obviously it's not good to indulge in those feelings, but if you're in a relationship, then it's not a problem. The erotic feelings themselves is not a problem. But if it makes you do things that break the precepts, to sleep outside of your committed relationship, or it arises if you're a monk or nun, then it's obviously something that's undesirable because it distracts away from the practice. So for us, we just kind of contemplate on the one, it passes away, and two, it's you know, kind of what we call the under practice of the body. We because lust is, you know, viewing the thing from one way, so you want to kind of rebalance it. You see the body is something that's really beautiful. And a few people have had an interview with myself at the Sangha house, and there to remind us, we have a skull on the shrine. Real skull, somebody's skull on the shrine, and this, some people can be very morbid or, you know, kind of strange, but for us it's just a simple reflection that when we carry these things in each and every one of us, we all have a skull sitting inside our head. It's a simple vehicle, and when you look at that, you see that everybody has a skull. The most beautiful lady has a skull. The most handsome man got a skull inside as well, and so that takes away from the allure of lust. And also lust is also a distraction. It's not very peaceful. We have a clarity of mind to reflect this, so you can see that it's actually you're feeling erotic, feeling lustful, you want to satisfy it. You have to look for an object to so the mind starts to move, find ways to satisfy it. And that's not very peaceful. So that's then just notice the danger in these feelings. But with anything, you know, work through it patiently. And just have the inclination to work through it. So in terms of, you know, answering your question, sometimes the body is, but sometimes it's just a different kind of reflection also as well. What happens you do outside of it. I think, I'm not so prone so much lust, but obviously many monks and nuns, it comes up from time to time. And that's a mark. And his thing was that whenever he's caught in lust, that's all you can think about, especially if you're young monk, you're 20s or something. It obsesses the mind. He says, you know, sometimes you can't even sleep. But do anything, you just kind of hang on to this kind of, I'm not going to do anything to break my peace test. I'm just going to endure it. Basically, that's like a child thing. Just endure these feelings that come up. And once it passes away, then you can reflect. See clearly that the body is not so attractive, but when it's in this thing, you can't. Even if you try to see the body is unattractive, no, it's still attractive. I still like it. But so when you reflect that, when it passes away, then you can say, well, with anything, these things pass away as well. So next time you're attacked by lust, you say, oh, okay, these things, you know, it's not going to be forever. It will come and it will go as well. So yes, so basically sometimes the only thing you can do is just endurance. Just be with it. And not try to push it away, not try to feel guilty that you have these feelings, because it's natural. We're conditioned from, you know, very early on to find pleasure in sensuality, in bodies and in feelings. Yeah. So not to push it away, but also not to come towards it. Kind of middle way. To hold it with gentleness, but not too close. Does that help? Questions or comments? Slightly after 9 o'clock. I'm just going to give a quick talk just on kind of something which a lot of people were surrounding that is mindfulness. So this ability just to be aware of whatever is happening in the present moment, to know where your body is,
What does that feel like? To know where's your mind? What am I feeling right now? Happy, sad, content? Want to be somewhere else? Where am I? So always kind of repeat that kind of mantra to yourself. Where am I right now? Where am I? And just to be here. And mindfulness is a great tool to have. Because it does two things. Once you know where you are, you're in the present moment, you can see whether the things you're doing will create, you know, suffering for yourself or happiness. How you react to things. But also with mindfulness, it's a natural clarity to know where you should be heading. So there's two aspects to mindfulness. One is to know what's happening in the present moment. Two is to know whether this is wholesome or not. Whether you're heading in the right direction. So let's say feeling of, you know, sensuality, erotic feelings comes up. Yeah, you know, okay, this is what's happening. But then you'll say, am I indulging? Am I giving way to fantasy? Am I giving way to these things? Or am I moving away from it? How am I related to this? And that's a great tool, because once you know yourself, sometimes these kind of defilements of the mind, these negative feelings, they go right away. Defilements of the mind or negative thoughts and feelings are very shy. As long as once you know them, they go away. And that's why mindfulness is a great protector. To making, you know, to whatever we're doing. And that's why this meditation is about strengthening this mindfulness. What am I doing? Is it leading towards my happiness or leading towards more suffering and stress? And the symbol is not something very kind of, you know, abstruse, abstract, but it's just, you know, what's happening? So just keep that in mind. And once your mind is sharpened, stillness happens automatically. It's like, you know, when in the beginning, when you're riding a bicycle, how much pressure to put in your right hand, left hand, where you can coordinate everything at the same time, you can pedal and all that stuff, how do I turn left, all those things. It's like meditation, like, what do I focus on? But after a while, it comes naturally. You can relax, and you know, the mind has nowhere to focus on it. And it happens, it's a kind of automatic process. Like when you're riding a bicycle, you have to worry about balancing yourself, you have to turn left and right, just it does it naturally. So the same, once mindfulness is strong, it stays with its object, it's stable, and you can watch each and every breath, one after the other, clearly, without missing one. And it's not through your force of will, but happens as, you know, as a natural condition, through happiness. The mind likes what it's doing, it's comfortable, and it knows what it's doing, through continuous training, through persistence. You've been doing it for, you know, years, weeks, whatever. Just the mind just slowly does it naturally. So that's why mindfulness is an important thing to focus on. But like I say, it's not from force of will, just it's gentleness, just know what's happening. Focus on the breath, force my mind and breath. Like I say, you know, and just be careful. After meditation, just check in the body. You feel more relaxed. You feel more tense and you say, okay, maybe I'm too much force in there. So just to kind of test, always test. It's a naturally, progressively comfortable path. Path of happiness. Path of, you know, of relaxation. Not more tension. Not more controlling. The path of letting go. So those are the few words I'd like to offer you to contemplation tonight. A few tools that you can use towards your practice and meditation. May you continue the path of letting go, the path of happiness and ultimate liberation. Noble silence. Just to remind people that we are still inclining towards noble silence. So please, if you have to talk to another person, please keep it away from the main areas. especially like the sala, and the way to the kitchen when there's a lot of people there. So outside of the work period, you should, like Ajahn Brahm said, follow these three rules, the three criteria before you talk. Before you say anything to the next person, outside the work period, and in the sala or in the kitchen, you have to ask yourself, is it really important? It's going to make a difference. Is it really important? Then you said, yeah, it's important, I have to say this. You should talk right away. But wait again. You ask yourself a second question. Is it really, really important? Then you have to say, it's really, really important. You still can't talk yet. You have to say another question. Being Buddhist, you have to do three times. Is it really, really, really important? Now, only you tick that box, can you say something to another person. Okay? By the time you tick that box, the person's gone. But still, we don't want to be we don't want to be a core wat, we don't have to be disciplined sergeants or anything. But please, it is a gift we're trying to offer each other. Because it is, there's 45 people here. So once one person starts to talk, it gets very loud very quickly. So it's just kind of a way to, a gift to the people around us, to practice, and to rejoice in people's kind of silence and peacefulness. Then we're trying to keep talking to a minimum, if it's possible. Obviously, that is, you have to do talking, you have to say something to somebody, it's important. There's a fire in the kitchen or something, yes please, by all means. Say something to somebody. But otherwise, we try to look inward. Thank you for that. Good night. You can continue sitting, or you can call it a night, and we'll see you all tomorrow. Yeah, it's the end of the year tonight. And so, generally, if we do a midnight sit on all full moon, we do between 9 to 12 that you celebrate the full moon. And also, since it's a new year, usually in different monasteries, you will sit all night. But generally, we won't torture you guys with that. We'll give you a present if you're not having to sit. But also, with in terms of New Year's, Buddhism is a new year every day. Every day we wake up, we have the potential to influence, we have the potential to react, to think in a new way. From clarity, from kindness and gentleness, not from our habitual tendencies. So with a new year, instead of making resolutions that we feel guilty we don't keep them, maybe we can incline our mind towards whatever I'm interested in. Just to be in the present moment. Wherever I am, I'm going to be here. I'm not going to make a resolution. My resolution is no resolution. To be content with whatever is happening. You don't have to be a better self, to be more fit, lose weight, join the gym. Everybody does that for the first 3 days. Everybody joins the gym. You don't have to do any of that. You don't have to join the minute. You don't have to make kind of strong resolutions about how much meditation you're going to do, or how many retreats you're going to go this year. No, my only encouragement for your New Year resolution is to be absolutely content wherever you happen to be, wherever you are on your spiritual path, to be the person that you are. Completely content with that. Then you have a great year. So with that, I wish you all a wonderful New Year 2010.